All right, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started. I suspect you all have a pretty good idea of what we've got going on here. Now, but we're the Public Utilities Commission, and this is our public one of our three public input hearings on docket HP09-001. And that's just the way we categorize the filing that's been made by TransCanada for the construction of their Keystone XL pipeline. We'll sort of lead off with, legally give you an outline, sort of read through some of the stuff we've got to get out of the way to begin with, give you an idea of what we've got going on, and then we'll move forward. But the purpose of this hearing really is twofold. First off, we want the applicant, TransCanada, to have an opportunity to tell all of us about what they've got planned. And then secondly, and far more importantly, we want to provide an opportunity on the record for you all to ask questions and to make your concerns and comments known to the commission so those can kind of guide us as we move forward on our process. Now, a copy of the application is on file with the county auditors in those affected counties, and that includes Harding, Butte, Perkins, Meade, Pennington, Hawken, Jones, Lyman, and Tripp. But I think probably the best place to get access to the information, if you've got internet access, is on our website, which is www.puc.sd.gov. And there's the complete application. There's all kinds of good information up there. And as we get other filings, they'll be posted up there. I think it's a pretty useful site. And we'll point out our staff members shortly, and they should be able to help walk you through how to get there if you talk to them tonight. So right now, the parties to this proceeding are the applicant and the commission. Under South Dakota law, each municipality, county, and governmental agency in the area may be granted party status, as well as any other interested person or entity. And you've got until May 11th to request party status. Now, for most of you, you're not going to need party status to make your voices heard. You'll be able to use comments and questions tonight to make your opinions known, or just after the fact, really at any point between now and when the commission renders the decision, you can send us a letter, you can send us an email via our website or electronic filing, and that sort of feedback helps us as we move forward in the process. So you don't need to do anything else other than just send us a letter or speak up if you want your voices heard. If you want to become a formally recognized legal intervener, which means you can call witnesses and you can cross-examine witnesses and you subject yourself to discovery and you can ask discovery of the other parties, a pretty complex legal involvement in the case, you can do that too, and that's what that party status is, and that deadline is May 11th. But there's no deadline if you just want to make your voices heard in a general way. And we do have applications, if you here available with us tonight, if you want to be want to apply for party status. So for the permit to be approved, the applicant's got to show four things. First off, that the project will comply with all the applicable laws and rules. Secondly, that this project will not pose a threat of serious injury to the environment or to the social and economic condition of the inhabitants or the expected inhabitants of this siting area. Third, that the project will not substantially impair the health, safety, or welfare of the inhabitants. And fourth, that the project will not unduly interfere with the orderly development of the region. Now, based on those factors, the commission can decide at the end of the whole process what it's going to do, and we've really got three options. First is to deny the permit, and then the project wouldn't move forward. We can approve the permit, meaning the project would move forward as the applicant has proposed, or we could approve the permit based on whatever terms and conditions on the construction or operation or anything else that the commission felt was necessary. We're going to begin by having the applicant make a 30-minute presentation to explain the project. And then following that, we're going to open this up. Normally, we would have a court reporter. Our court reporter had a conflict tonight so that she could not be here. And as a result, we're audio taping this, and then she'll make a transcript after the fact. But when it comes time for you to speak, we would ask that you first say your name, and then spell your last name, unless it's a very common spelling, and then let us know that. And then third, tell us where you're from. And if you haven't taken an opportunity to sign up on the sign-up sheet back there, please do. Even if you don't plan on speaking tonight, we'd like you to sign up there because that's our record of whether or not people took an interest in this proceeding and whether or not they attended. With regard to questions and comments, we would ask two things. Number one, we want to be respectful of everybody's time here. I know everybody's got a lot of stuff going on tonight, so we'd ask that you not be repetitive. You know, if Jerry says something you agree with, rather than repeat that, you can just get up and say, and I want you to know that I agree with Jerry, that's my feeling as well. And that way we've got you on the record as being in support or having concerns, but we don't have to have a lot of repetitive comments. And secondly, you try to stay on topic. I sort of read the four things that they've got to prove to be able to move forward, and we're going to try to keep you on task. We'll allow a little flexibility because we understand that, you know, we want to explore a few issues, but we're probably going to try to keep it pretty close on the areas that we're going to be looking at with this. So with that, I'll pause and we'll introduce. I'm Commissioner Dusty Johnson. Other commissioners here tonight are Steve Kolbeck and Gary Hansen. We've got the Commission General Counsel John Smith with us up here. Behind us, we've got Mr. Tim Binder with the Commission. In the back, we've got Mr. Bob Knadel. Although I don't see them, I suspect Ms. Stacy Splitstosher right back there. Ms. Kara Semler and Mr. Nathan Solem are also in the back. Those people certainly can help you if you have questions during break or after the fact. So with that, I'll pause and see if my colleagues, if I've forgotten anything. All right. So with that, Mr. Brett Kennecke will be the lead spokesman for TransCanada this evening. Mr. Kennecke, please introduce those with you tonight and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Commissioner Johnson, and thank you, Commissioners Kolbeck and Hansen. Also, a thanks to the Commission staff for their work in putting this meeting together tonight. My name is Brett Kennecke. I'm a lawyer from Peer, and I represent TransCanada Keystone Pipeline in this proceeding before the PUC. We appreciate your coming here very much tonight. We look forward to providing you with a little bit of information about the project and then engaging in a dialogue with you about it. We're going to try and answer your questions to the best of our ability and to your satisfaction. We look forward to hearing your comments that you offer to the Commission here tonight, and if you'll bear with us, we've got a short presentation that we'd like to give you. Seated right to my left is Robert Jones, the Vice President of TransCanada for the Keystone Pipelines. Next to him is John Phillips, who's in charge of construction, and he's an engineer from Houston, Texas. And Jim White next to him is a representative of the Keystone TransCanada group as well. Behind me are a number of subject matter experts, people who are both employees of TransCanada and contractors of TransCanada who have specific expertise in a number of the things that we think your questions are going to be about here tonight. So we'll be calling on them from time to time to help answer your questions to your satisfaction.
Mr. Kennecke, we'll interrupt real quick. Mr. Calhoun, how are we coming in back there? Is the volume all right? Okay, sounds good. Thanks.
Thank you. With that, I'll turn the microphone over to Robert Jones.
Okay, first my ears, now my eyes. This might not work. Can you guys still hear me? Let me just move my mic a bit. Okay, we're done. Okay, are we good? Thank you, Commissioner Johnson, Commissioner Kolbeck, Commissioner Hansen, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Robert Jones, and I'm the Vice President of the Keystone Pipelines. We are here to present to you information regarding our proposed Keystone XL pipeline project and to listen to your concerns and answer your questions. But before I do that, I'd like to acknowledge and recognize that many of you have concerns about the construction and operation of a crude oil pipeline and how it may potentially impact your land. I want to provide you with two commitments. The Keystone XL pipeline will be designed, constructed, and operated safely and in an environmentally responsible manner. It is our commitment to treat landowners fairly and with respect. Now let me tell you about TransCanada and the project. Who is TransCanada? TransCanada is a North American energy infrastructure company. We have over 50 years of experience, and TransCanada Corporation is listed on the New York Stock Exchange. There are about 4,000 employees, and over one-third of them are based here in the United States. Our corporate headquarters is in Calgary, and our U.S. headquarters is in Houston. At TransCanada, we provide reliable supplies of energy across the continent, and we're proud that millions of North Americans depend on us for their energy needs every single day. Now, there's two logos on this slide we're extremely proud of. TransCanada was named to the Dow Jones Sustainability World Index for the seventh year in a row. And for the third consecutive year, TransCanada was recognized as one of the Global 100 most sustainable companies. These programs rank companies worldwide based on their environmental record and other key factors such as a relationship with communities and with stakeholders. Now this map gives you a geographic reach of our pipeline, not only our pipeline, but our power assets. We operate over 40,000 miles of pipeline assets, either wholly owned or in partnership with others. We also operate a growing fleet of power generation facilities. We have wind, hydropower, nuclear, natural gas power generation facilities. We supply electrical power in both the throughout Canada and the United States. We are an energy infrastructure company with operations in Mexico, United States, and Canada. And we have ongoing relationships with over 40,000 landowners. Now, TransCanada has been in South Dakota since the early 80s. We were an owner of the Northern Border Pipeline System, and this system delivers natural gas to people of South Dakota and the Midwest. We now own and operate the Northern Border Pipeline, and its headquarters is in Omaha, Nebraska, but it also has a maintenance base in Brookings, South Dakota. Now, the Keystone Field U.S. operations will also be in Omaha, Nebraska, and we're going to have a number of maintenance bases here in South Dakota. Now, why Keystone XL? This pipeline will connect the world's second largest oil reserve with the world's largest refining market. Canada has the second largest oil reserves in the world, and the Gulf Coast is home to the world's largest refining market. On this map, you can see that Venezuela and many of these Middle Eastern countries are not friendly trading partners to the United States. So it's easy to see why Canada is increasing in importance as a supplier of energy to the United States. Canada is currently the leading supplier of oil to the U.S., supplying about 2.2 million barrels of the 20 million barrels consumed every day. It's Canadian oil that's growing in supply as a supply source to the U.S., and we are the United States' largest trading partner. And Canada certainly is a secure and reliable trading partner. So Canada provides an opportunity for us to replace Middle Eastern, Venezuelan, and Mexican sources of oil. Refineries located in the Gulf Coast represent nearly 50% of the total U.S. refining capacity. Gulf Coast refineries generally are served by offshore supplies from the Middle East, Venezuela, and Mexico via tankers. Now, these shipments are subject to severe weather disruptions like Hurricane Rita and Katrina and other production disruptions. Now, these refineries provide the gasoline and the diesel and the lube oils and the fertilizer and other products that each of us use every day. And most of these products are transported to South Dakota by a pipeline from either Gulf Coast refineries or from Cushing area refineries. Now, the Keystone XL pipeline is designed to deliver an initial capacity of 700,000 barrels per day, and it'll be expandable to 900,000 barrels a day. Keystone XL will be operated as an integrated system, integrated with the Keystone pipeline system. Its maximum capacity of the combined Keystone system is about 1.5 million barrels per day. Now, the need for this pipeline is demonstrated by the long-term contract commitments. U.S. refiners and crude oil marketers have executed binding contracts for over 910,000 barrels with an average term of over 18 years. Now, the Keystone XL estimated cost is $7 billion, and with the $5 billion estimated cost for the Keystone project, the combined Keystone pipeline system is estimated to cost $12 billion. So in terms of timing, we will place the first phase of the Keystone pipeline in service later this year, and we'll begin deliveries to the refineries in the Wood River and Patoka, Illinois area. In 2010, we're scheduled to construct the extension to Cushing to deliver crude oil to the Oklahoma-based refineries. Now, pending on regulatory approvals for the Keystone XL construction project, construction will occur here in South Dakota in 2011 and 2012. Now, here's a map showing the proposed route in South Dakota, passing through portions of Harding, Butte, Perkins, Meade, Pennington, Hawken, Jones, Lyman, and Tripp counties. The capital cost of the Keystone XL project in South Dakota is about $920 million, and the pipeline's about 313 miles in length and 36 inches in diameter. Now, an example of this pipe can be found in the back of the room. There are also going to be 7 pump stations to keep the oil flowing through the line and 16 mainline and check valves in addition to the 7 pump stations. Now, Dennis Calhoun, our manager of the Keystone XL land, he's our land manager. He's in the back there. And if any of you are interested in looking at any detailed route maps, please come and go and see him. Now, pipelines are subjected to significant federal and state regulation review. On the federal side, the Department of State will review the Keystone application for a presidential permit because we cross an international boundary. But the Department of State will also be the lead agency to meet the requirements under the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. Now, there are a dozen or more federal agencies that will also review the project. They are the Army Corps of Engineers, the Department of Transportation, the Bureau of Land Management, and Fish and Wildlife. Now, the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission has siting authority to review the project. But in addition to them, the project is subject to review from other state authorities. That includes the South Dakota Department of Environment and Natural Resources, or the DENR, and the South Dakota State Historic Society. Now, this map shows that there's over 1.3 million miles of oil pipelines and gas pipelines in the United States. Now, we tend not to notice pipelines because they're, once they're in the ground, because of course they're buried. But pipelines deliver nearly all of the natural gas and nearly all of the oil, or all of the gasoline, and all of the diesel that we use here in South Dakota and in the United States. And the reason is pipelines are the safest and most efficient mode of transportation. Now, interstate pipelines are regulated under federal regulations. And within the Department of Transportation, there's this agency called the Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, or we refer to them as PHMSA. They regulate pipeline safety. Now, the PHMSA office for South Dakota is based in Kansas City. Now, in addition to helping meet U.S. demand for oil, Keystone XL will also deliver some local benefits to South Dakota. We estimate between $20 and $30 million will be directly injected into the South Dakota economy. Pipeline contractors and pump station contractors will purchase food, lodging, construction consumables, and other supplies. Keystone will be the largest private construction project in South Dakota. The workforce is estimated to be about 1,200 workers per year in both 2011 and 2012. But by far the largest benefit to South Dakota will be the property tax revenue collected every year by the 9 counties and 13 school districts that the pipeline will traverse. We estimate that the first year property tax revenue in South Dakota to be about $10.3 million. And state aid to education payments are estimated to be reduced by $5.2 million. So there will be a significant reduction in the tax burden benefiting the local property taxpayers. Now, another benefit will be the reinforcement of the local co-op's electrical infrastructure. Now, route selection is a multi-step process. First, we need to identify the project objectives. And for Keystone XL, the objective was to transport Canadian oil to Gulf Coast refineries and to construct the pipeline in the most direct route possible from a source in Harding, Alberta, to connect up with the Steel City, Nebraska Keystone system. And secondly, we had to identify major control points. They were the entry point into the United States, the Fort Peck Reservoir, and the Charles Russell National Wildlife Refuge. With the project objectives and the major control points, you now have what we call defined a study area. And data is collected from soliciting input from various agencies and the public and from doing field surveys. Once we have all the data, we identify constraints like environmentally sensitive areas, local terrain issues, and cultural features. The study area showed that there were no linear northwest to southeast features that we could follow. So we also developed and assessed various alternatives. Now, there will be additional input and route refinements as a result of further surveys and further field work and further regulatory review. We developed a comprehensive construction mitigation and reclamation plan to minimize environmental impacts based on best industry practices. Now, there are a number of agencies that will review and stipulate environmental protection measures. The Department of State and other federal agencies will attach environmental mitigation conditions to minimize these impacts. And the PUC and state agencies will also identify additional environmental mitigation conditions. So Keystone will minimize the impact on the project on the environment in South Dakota by using these construction and restoration measures and conditions. Now I'll ask John Phillips, he's our manager of engineering construction, to describe how the pipeline is constructed and including the easement impacts necessary for that construction. John?
Thanks, Robert. To construct and operate the pipeline, Keystone will negotiate with landowners for a 50-foot wide permanent easement, as well as an additional 60 feet of temporary construction workspace. Landowners will be able to ranch and farm over the permanent easement after construction. Some areas, such as streams, roads, and railroad crossings, as well as rough and hilly terrain, may require some additional temporary workspace to safely complete construction. In addition, Keystone will obtain rights for access roads. temporary workspace will revert back to the landowner after construction. In South Dakota, the project's divided into spreads, about 80 to 95 miles in length, a length that can be constructed in a single construction season. The pipeline is constructed like an assembly line, made up of separate crews, each with a different task. Over 2 years, a total of approximately 2,500 construction workers will be spread over the length of the pipeline in the state. 500 to 600 construction personnel will work on each spread. Work will progress at about 1 to 1.5 miles per day for each crew on a spread. After the right-of-way has been cleared and graded, the topsoil is stripped from the right-of-way, as shown on the right, and segregated away from the ditch spoils, which is shown on the left, in order to prevent mixing. Pipe is delivered by train to rail sidings, unloaded, and trucked to pipe yards, which are adjacent to the right-of-way. Pipe in 80-foot lengths is loaded onto trucks at the pipe yard, delivered and strung along the right-of-way, and bent to conform to the contour of the ditch. The ditch is dug using a wheeled ditching machine or a backhoe. The ditch spoils are separated from the topsoil to prevent mixing. The pipe is welded together using an automated, mechanized, or manual welding process. Each weld is inspected using an ultrasonic inspection tool or radiography to ensure that it meets quality requirements. The weld areas are sandblasted and coated. The pipe coating is inspected to ensure its integrity before it's lowered into the ditch. The pipe is lowered into the ditch in segments, and the segments are welded together at tie-in points. In areas of significant rock, the pipe is padded with select material, and the ditch is backfilled with ditch spoils. After the contours have been restored to the original grade, the area is loosened to reduce compaction, and the topsoil is spread back across the right-of-way, and the area is reseeded using specified seed mixes. Prior to digging, in compliance with state law, we contact the South Dakota One Call, who identifies the location of existing buried utilities. These existing utilities will often provide an on-site representative to inspect during excavation, as Keystone will when you call after construction. The pipe is fitted with test heads filled with water and hydrostatically tested to 125% of the operating pressure to comply with code requirements. In addition, the pipe is inspected internally with a device called a pig that's used to inspect the pipe from the inside for dents and ovality. Although construction will disturb your land, we will take great care to restore the land as close as possible to its pre-construction condition. We'll go to Robert Jones for the next slides. Robert?
Thanks, John. Now, Keystone will meet or exceed all applicable codes and regulations. Now, we talked previously about the regulatory reviews associated with proposal to build a pipeline. Now, there are a separate set of regulations, requirements, and industry standards that apply to the design of a pipeline, and they help ensure pipeline safety and the integrity for as long as we will operate the pipeline. Now, industry standards reflect the knowledge that we have gained through more than 100 years of pipeline experience in North America. These regulations and standards are intended to ensure the protection of the public, the environment, and to prevent pipeline failures. Keystone XL's design will reflect state-of-the-art safety features. For example, regulations require 2.5 feet depth of cover. Keystone XL will be constructed with 4 feet of depth of cover, and that's to minimize the risk of the pipe being accidentally struck by a third party after it's installed. Although pipe failure is rare, when it has occurred, it's the third party contact that is the leading cause. Now, at TransCanada, we've also developed a specification for a high strength steel pipe, and that exceeds the existing standard for the fabrication of a large diameter pipeline. TransCanada's specification for external pipe protective coating is fusion bond epoxy. This corrosion preventive coating has virtually eliminated external corrosion as a source of failure in pipes. In the more than 29 years that TransCanada has been using fusion bond epoxy coating, we have never had a pipe failure due to corrosion. Cathodic protection provides an additional protection if the coating is damaged after it's installed. We also install marker signs at road crossings, and we bury warning tape at every utility crossing to act as an additional warning to these utilities when they cross the pipeline. There's also isolation valves that are strategically located to protect the environment in the event of a release. Now, the entire pipeline system Now, safety features associated with construction of the pipe include the following things that we're going to do. Keystone will only solicit pipe bids for mills that have met TransCanada's quality standards. We then supply direct oversight in the steel mills and in the pipe mills and all the handling, in the pipe mills during fabrication and oversight during handling it to the site. During construction, all the welds are checked and qualified by an X-ray and ultrasonic technician. Now, there's over 40 inspectors that monitor the various crews along the pipeline during construction. Now, before the pipe is lowered into the ditch, the coating is checked to ensure of its integrity. We also inspect the pipe internally using a caliper pig, and that ensures that it has met the specifications. Now, land agents will be available and will be communicating with you during construction, so you're aware of all the construction activities. Now, the entire pipeline system is monitored 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, by highly trained, qualified employees from a computerized control center. And we have a backup center that also provides redundant oversight capability. And we have dual communication systems and multiple leak detection systems. Keystone has a pipeline integrity management program that will maintain the quality of the pipeline throughout the life. And Keystone has a damage prevention program that includes participation in the South Dakota One Call. Aerial surveillance or line control will occur 26 times a year, not to exceed 3 weeks. This is why we usually have podiums. In the unlikely event of a release, Keystone will implement its emergency response program to protect the safety of the public, the environment, to minimize damage to property, and to company operations. The emergency response program will be submitted to PHMSA, and the South Dakota Department of Energy and Natural Resources. Keystone's public awareness program will communicate our emergency response plan to stakeholders such as community first responders. Keystone employees and contractors will be trained as first responders to address an emergency. Keystone will work with the community first responders, such as local law enforcement and the fire departments, to be aware of our role and our capabilities, and that they are to address public safety and to secure the site. Keystone's commitment is to design, construct, and operate a safe pipeline. We want to build it and operate it in a socially and environmentally responsible manner. We will meet or exceed industry and government standards, and we're going to consult with the stakeholders. Keystone will treat landowners with fairness and respect. We look forward to being a part of your community and a good neighbor. Now, Keystone continues to operate a project website. We have email, a toll-free line, and we want to do that so we can receive and respond to your inquiries so we can ongo further consultation. Now, you'll find the toll-free number and the project website address on the back of any Keystone XL brochure, and there's some in the back. Dennis Calhoun is also here, and he'll be able to talk to landowners after the meeting. I want to thank you very much for coming here tonight and for listening to us. Commissioner.
Thanks very much to the applicant. Before we get started, there was some information in... Mr. Kennecke, there was some information in the Rapid City Journal that I think you've indicated was not accurate. Maybe before we get started, your team can let folks know those clarifications.
Buttons up. There we go. Thank you, Commissioner. We appreciate that opportunity. We'd like to be brief about it. I think we'll call on Bill Taylor to present some tax information in order to correct what was in the Rapid City Journal this morning.
It's like a barrier. You can't go past it.
Thanks. My name is Bill Taylor. I'm a lawyer from Sioux Falls. Am I on?
No. You just have to be real close to your mic.
Close to the mouth.
Better?
No.
Better?
Stick it in my mouth. All right, so I'll start over again. I'm not used to a microphone. I normally don't have any trouble projecting, so if you can't hear me, raise your hand. My name is Bill Taylor. I'm a lawyer from Sioux Falls. I work for TransCanada. They asked me to figure out what the tax impact of the TransCanada pipeline was going to be in South Dakota. So I did that. I didn't read the Rapid City Journal article today. I don't read the Argus Leader either, you know, and I think I don't have to tell any of you why that is. But I will tell you what the tax situation is going to be in Harding County. And I want to make this as simple and as straightforward as I can. We made a couple of slides. Put the first one up, would you? Okay. Right now, the total assessed valuation of all the real estate in Harding County is about $152 million. What that says is, if this is the borders of Harding County, your tax assessor says the total value of all the property in the county is $152 million. Now, if you know how taxes work in South Dakota, every one of you who owns a piece of real property every year in March gets the assessed valuation from the assessor. And that's supposed to be the equalized value of your property. That is, your property assessed equal to all other similar property in the county. Then in the summertime, all of the agencies, the county commissioners, the school and so forth, all gather up and they figure out what their budget is going to be for the coming year. And the county treasurer, working with the director of equalization, figures out how much money in dollars has to be raised from this $152 million of tax, of real property assessed valuation, to pay for all the operations of government in the county and in the school system. And then they divide that up. So if the assessed valuation of your property is $100,000, they figure out how many mills it takes, or what, how many dollars per thousand it takes to raise all the money needed for government. Pretty straightforward system. Here's what's going to happen when this pipeline gets built. And I got to tell you how we arrived at these numbers first. The law in South Dakota says that a pipeline is supposed to be valued taking into account three factors: its cost, the income it produces, and its market value. Just exactly like your house or ranch. You know, everybody in this room who's in the agricultural business knows that effective 2009, your agricultural property is going to be taxed based on its capacity to produce, its income. Big change in the law. Very similar with a pipeline company. But there's two problems with figuring out the tax impact in South Dakota. And the first of the two problems is we're not in business yet. So we don't know what the income is going to be. Remember, three approaches. The first one is the income approach. We don't know what the income is going to be. And we don't know what the market value is going to be. In other words, we don't know what somebody else would pay to buy that pipeline. What we do know is what it's going to cost to build. In South Dakota, the pipeline company is going to spend $921 million. Just for those of you who are interested, that's the single biggest, largest construction expenditure in the history of the state with private dollars. $921 million, shade less than a billion. In Harding County, there'll be about 71 miles of pipeline. And there'll be two pump stations. And the pump stations cost someplace between $21 and $25 million each, depending on the nature of the pump station. And then 71 miles of pipeline. So here's what we did. We figured out the total mileage all the way across South Dakota, and we computed the total construction cost all the way across South Dakota, and we divided it up mile for mile. So we figured out what it costs to build 1 mile of the pipeline, and attributed 71 and a fraction of those miles to Harding County, plus two pump stations. And that number is $222 million. All right, so today, all the real estate in Harding County is worth $152 million. We're going to add $222 million to that. When it's all said and done, in Harding County, the value of all the real estate, which will now include the pipeline, will be $374 million. So, let's just think about the impact that has. Let's assume that the cost of government does not change. That you get a lock on your school board and you get a lock on your county commissioners, and next year it's going to cost exactly the same to run your government as it cost last year. Now, I'll give you a little caveat here. When we worked these numbers out, the way we did it is we had to have some place to start. We knew what all the tax figures were throughout the state of South Dakota for 2008. So we pretended that the pipeline was completed and constructed and completely taxable in 2008 and tried to figure out what the impact would be. In actuality, the pipeline will not be constructed till 10 or 13.
Mr. Taylor, how much longer do we have on this piece of the...
Maybe 5 minutes to finish it.
Okay, if we could, because we do want to hear from folks, so if we could cut to it.
What it amounts to is we're going to double the tax base. 2.4 times tax base is going to increase in Harding County, which means that you've got 2.4 times as much money, taxable assessed valuation, over which to spread the cost of government. Simple math says that taxes in Harding County are going to go down by over half as a consequence of the pipeline. Commissioner Colbeck wants to know, does any of that money go to Pier? The answer is no. None of the money goes to Pier. Stays here.
Okay, thanks very much, Mr. Taylor. At this point, let's see if we've got any questions for the applicant. What we would ask you to do is to raise your hand. We'll run a mic over to you. Just as a reminder, state your name, spell your last name, please, and let us know where you live. And let's see if we've got any questions for the applicant.
Leonard Nygaard, NYGAARD. My question is, what is the expected lifetime of this project, of the pipeline?
Thank you, sir. Good question. So because of this, connect the second largest reserves in the world with the largest market in the world, as long as we're still continuing to use oil, and I suspect that'll be the case for generations, we're designing the pipeline and we're going to operate and maintain it so it can last for generations as well. So the answer is we don't know how long, but it's certainly as long as we need to move oil to the refineries so we can produce diesel and gasoline. So the question is what happens when we're done? Well, what happened in a pipeline that we built in 1957 is that we converted it from natural gas service to oil service. So pipelines tend, if they're well maintained, then what you can do is you can convert the service. So it could be used to transport some other product like natural gas. If at the end of that time, the end of that life, we have to abandon the line, in other words, its life has ended, then we'll follow whatever the regulations may be and whatever the standards may be. And we'll go through the same process we are going through here today. But we can only speculate what that would be because it's going to be many, many generations from now.
Other questions? Good question.
Brett Clanton, C-L-A-N-T-O-N from Buffalo. My question is, what effect will a cheaper quality tar sands oil have on domestic oil supplies and prices?
This pipeline is designed to move all types of oils. So whether it's synthetic crude oil or conventional crude oil, whether that's sweet, medium, or the heavy crude oils that are now coming out of the oil sands. Now, the oil that's coming out of the oil sands is the area that's growing the most. So today, Canada produces about 3 million barrels of oil, and about 2.2 million barrels is imported into the United States. And that oil has no sand in it. There's this misconception that there's sand in that oil, and there isn't any. They take the sand out of the oil, and it looks like any other oil. That's a heavy oil, similar to the ones you get in Venezuela, or in San Joaquin Valley in California, or other places in the world. Because it has to meet the specifications of the refineries here in the United States. So, we are the transporter. We don't own the oil, and we don't refine the oil. Sometimes I like to call us a trucker or the mailman. We just move the product.
Mr. Clanton also asked about if there'd be any effect on the price of oil. Didn't you, Mr. Clanton, did you ask about cheaper tar sands oil?
Yes, the effects on supply and price.
Yes.
Commissioner Johnson, I think it's really unreasonable to expect a pipeline company to have an understanding of the price of oil. But we all read the paper, and I can tell you that the price of oil last year is a heck of a lot different than the price of oil is this year. So obviously it's a very dynamic market, and it's impacted by a lot of factors, political factors. And this year, of course, it was the economy. So the answer is I have no idea what the price will be.
Thanks. Other questions?
My name is Linda Gilbert, G-I-L-B-E-R-T. I live in Buffalo. My question is actually for the PUC commissioners. I'm not clear about how our laws work in South Dakota. Do you as a governing body have the ability to request as part of your permitting process TransCanada to do bonds for like impacts on roads. Also, like for emergency plans, I don't believe TransCanada's filed an emergency plan as part of their process. Of, you know, they referred to it in this presentation, but I don't believe there's been one that's filed. And I'm just curious what your role in this is. Can you require that?
I'll take a first stab, and then Mr. Smith and the commissioners can fill in. First off, with regard to your question on the first was what?
Like requiring a bond for impact that we're going to have on roads, forth in Harding County.
Yeah, thank you very much. State law does allow the commission to require a bond to repair any potential damages to township and county roads. Bonds were required 2 years ago in the commission order for the Keystone Pipeline that was approved for East River, South Dakota. First year of construction, a $3 million bond was required, and in the second year of construction, I believe it was $12 million bond. State law does give us that authority. With regard to a safety plan, in the commission's order from two years ago again, there were a number of requirements, conditions that we placed on that approval. And a number of those conditions had to do with the filing of additional information once it was completed. Those plans need to be reviewed by the federal government, the Department of Environment and Natural Resources, and pursuant with the PUC order, also the Public Utilities Commission. Those plans are not routinely done in advance during this sort of regulatory phase, but would be done prior to operation of the pipeline. But with that, I'm going to pause and see if Commissioners Hansen and Colbeck have anything to add.
That everything that Mr. Johnson said is true. They do have, I know you directed the question to us, but I know that TransCanada does have people who specialize in the safety program if you'd like to hear from them. But as Commissioner Johnson said, bonds, there was $15 million worth of bonds, and those bonds are actually released by us. There's no date certain on those. As soon as the commission is satisfied that the roads have been repaired, then we can release those bonds.
And have those bonds been required for XL?
I'm sorry, what was that?
And have you required bonds for the XL project then?
I can't. Oh, go ahead.
Matt, excuse me, I'm Commissioner Gary Hansen. We're in that process at the present time. So that would come with the order from the Public Utilities Commission. If obviously the state law requires us to reach a decision within 1 year. We had 57 contingencies on the Keystone Pipeline on the eastern side of South Dakota. In one of those contingencies, there were 13 sub-contingencies. I would anticipate that as part of the process here that Keystone will include some of those. We certainly, as a commission, will look at those. But we're in somewhat of a little bit of a challenging situation. We act as judges here, and we're going through the process right now of ascertaining concerns of the public. And we will, of course, insert our concerns and have our opportunity for an evidentiary hearings, and at which time, as Commissioner Johnson explained, all of you are certainly invited to participate in that. We wouldn't anticipate that you would, certainly. That's the purpose of us coming out here and going through the process. But we may very well have bonds required. We just cannot now, as can any judge, during the process, we can't say, yes, I'm going to require this or not. We cannot even speak to each other on this outside of an open hearing like we're having here because of the open meeting laws. So just to give you somewhat of a background of the process that we go through.
I guess I just had a comment then that I as an individual living in Harding County and given the very rural nature of our county, we're real concerned about the safety impact and even the ability, as you referred to the local volunteers, EMTs, emergency services, they're just not going to have the knowledge of fighting an oil-based fire. So therefore, I really would like to see those plans put out before you start construction. I sure would like to see what the safety plan is before we start this process.
Well, and I think perhaps at this time it'd be appropriate to turn to the applicant, because I think a lot of information, I mean, I suspect hundreds of pages of very specific information about the questions you're asking could be provided in advance of that particular filing required by the federal government. So let's get you the information. Let's turn to the applicant to start with.
Yes, thank you, Commissioner. And that's a great question. It does give us an opportunity to demonstrate to you and to describe to you our plans. So I'll ask Mr. Hayes to respond.
Thank you, Robert. Ladies and gentlemen and commissioners, my name is John Hayes, H-A-Y-E-S, and I work for TransCanada as a contractor. I specialize in emergency response. That's a very long question, and I'll just maybe keep it fairly brief. But for the Keystone Pipeline Project, we do have an emergency response plan in place now that was approved by PHMSA. We also sent a copy to the state. And for KXL, we will use the same platform, the same type of information, about 70% of that, and then develop the site-specific information at that time. So you have our guarantee that that plan will be in place well in advance of operations.
Mr. Hayes, we had a very important concern raised about first responders in this area. Can you give us an idea of what would be expected of and required of first responders from local governments?
Absolutely. Thank you. So for first responders, and I saw a number of you at the back, what our plan is to educate you, help you understand where our pipelines are, what's contained in our pipelines, and what your role is. And the real role at the end of the day is the same as ours, is public safety. What we ask you to do is help us secure the site and let us do our job and clean up the oil and repair the pipe. So it's very clear what your role is. It's public safety. Help us secure the site.
But, I mean, let's get a little specific. To what extent would volunteer firefighters be expected to be on the front lines dealing with an oil-based incident?
We would not expect them to help us out fighting crude oil fires at all.
I just want to add a question on the bonds. We would expect a bond at this case, and we would certainly be prepared to honor that bond as well. For the road damage, potential road damage.
Okay. Hold on. I just want to double check with staff, make sure somebody had has the name of that questioner.
She did it.
I have it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Solem. Okay, go ahead. Next question.
If you're done with that previous topic, my question was, are you going to be just transporting Canadian oil? Leonard Nygaard, will you just be transporting Canadian oil, or will you be able to pick up U.S. oil along the way and add to it, or what kind of an impact will it have on our industry?
Thank you very much for that question. Questions with regards to U.S. production, and will Keystone be able to move it? You know, Keystone's a common carrier pipeline. And we are, we've already started working with the North Dakota producers, and we've had some confidential discussions with them. I think it's really up to each producer to decide whether or not it makes economic sense to do that. And so we are working with the marketplace, and it's really a matter of whether or not it makes economic sense for those producers to use the Keystone Pipeline or for us to take oil off existing pipelines that comes from Canada that's causing a lot of the existing lines to be full. And so one of the issues is that a lot of the pipelines that are in the Dakotas or in Wyoming and Montana today are full because they're full of Canadian oil. So with this pipeline, that Canadian oil comes onto this line and frees up space on the other. So I think there will be a dynamic that will occur over the next few years.
Next question. Yes.
Stephanie Trask, T-R-A-S-K. If the company
Ms. Trask, I'm sorry, location?
Rapid City.
Okay, thanks.
If the company is not expecting any local help with emergency response, I would think that a condition of the state permit would be an emergency response plan in its entirety. Because, I mean, how long are we talking for response? What's the procedure? I would think that that needs to be a condition of the state permit.
And just as a clarification, Commissioner Hansen's absolutely right. We don't have any idea what we'll do with this particular permit, at least with the Keystone, the first one. Ms. Trask, you're absolutely right. That was a condition. You're absolutely right. In advance of operation. Yes, it was. An emergency response plan was it was a condition of the permit that it be filed before operation. Okay. So, point. I think you're right. Point well taken.
Okay. Also, I think Mr. Hayes has some maybe some additional information for you on the question.
Could I make one observation? I'm wondering if maybe based on what you may have been told, if maybe somebody you might be confusing that with the integrity management plan. Is that possible? Because there's two separate plans the company has to file. Well, maybe I'll let Mr. Hayes explain the difference or Ms. Kothari. One, well, I'll let you guys do that.
Mr. Hayes.
Okay, thanks. Ms. Trask, I'm not sure of your exact question, but the emergency response plan was filed and is complete, and it's for Keystone. And I indicated that we will be using the same platform again for KXL, about 80% of it roughly, and develop a site-specific one for KXL, the plan, the pipeline we're here to talk about today.
Can you wait until we get to microphone? You were going to clarify the difference between the emergency response and the integrity management that John Smith referred to?
Yes, Ms. Trask, I'll pass that part over to Ms. Kothari to answer that.
Mira Kothari, TransCanada Engineering. So the difference between the integrity management plan and the emergency response plan, as John mentioned, the emergency response plan is specifically in place to deal with emergencies. The integrity management plan, on the other hand, is the plan for the long-term maintenance of the pipeline. Under federal law, Code of Federal Regulations 49195, all operating companies are required to have a plan in place on how they will maintain the pipeline itself. Those plans need to follow specific definitions and guidelines and meet federal regulations. They have to do with frequency of maintenance for valves, have to do with inspection timings on internally inspecting the pipeline, and duration for repairs in terms of immediate response or long-term maintenance programs. As far as the filing, as Mr. Hayes mentioned, the emergency response plan has been filed. The integrity management plan is still under development. It will also go to PHMSA to be reviewed and also be filed with the commission. And that will be prior to operations.
Other questions? Just raise your hand and we'll get you a mic out there.
Derek Brink, B-R-I-N-K, from Riva. Questions for the construction manager of TransCanada. You'd stated that there was 80-foot pipe that was going to be on semis. And with that pipe, how do you plan on accessing these county roads with that kind of load? And the second part of that question is, are you having any dust control procedures in place for going by our places and also a speed control of your contractors?
Very good questions, all three. As far as there'll be a transportation plan as far as moving the pipe from the pipe yards to the right of way, the 80-foot joints on the trucks. As far as dust control, the contractor will have some water trucks that we'll use to control dust on the dirt roads. And speed control is part of the contractor safety plan. This is something that the contractor prepares before we begin construction. We go over the details of it with the contractor, and they're bound by that. If we have issues with trucks going too fast or them not doing the things they're supposed to do, then the construction management folks will take corrective action, and the contractor will have to take care of these things.
Sir, did they get you answered? Do you have a follow-up at all? Yeah, go ahead.
Our approaches here in Harding County probably don't take an 80-foot load. I'm just kind of wondering what you're going to do as far as pre-construction.
So I want to ask, just add to John's question or response. We'll work with the counties, and we certainly will have to do a lot of planning before we start it. So if there's areas, we're going to need a lot of private roads as well, so we're going to need to work with different landowners. And so there will be an ongoing consultation process with the county and with the landowners to make sure that we get the access required to safely get those joints of pipe onto the right-of-way. Your question on dust control, it's not only are we going to spray county roads that we are going to be accessing, but we also spray the right-of-way. So we know that it can get really dry, and when the wind picks up, you can have a dusty situation. So we do constantly spray the right-of-way as well as the roads.
Robert, can I just speak for a second?
Did we get you answered, sir? Okay, great, thanks. Other questions?
Yeah, I'm Tom Costello. I'm with Bledsoe Cattle Company, and I brought up some questions for the environmental protection people when they were here, and I didn't get all of my answers satisfactorily answered there because they didn't have the answers. Our biggest concerns about that pipeline going through us is the possibility of a spill. And there are several creeks that run through us, and some of them don't. The pipeline goes across them before they get to us, but they all run into the North Moro River. And those waterways, I'm concerned about if they told me that the pipeline would be responsible for all the cleanup and all that, but when I asked about paying the landowner for the time that he doesn't get to use the pastures because they've wrecked the waterways, and we also have some shallow wells that are close to where this pipeline is going to be, I was wondering what is in place to pay the landowner for the time that he can't use the pastures, and if there's any bond that makes sure that they have the money to protect us where they go through, because it might be, who knows, several years before we could use that river again for livestock water, depending on how long it took them to clean it up. And there's a lot of our pastures that is the biggest water source for our livestock that we might not be able to use them. I was just wondering, maybe the lawyer can tell me if we're going to have to go to court to get judgment to get damages back. I guess that's my question.
So who pays, Mr. Kenneke, Mr. Jones? Kind of walk us through the liability and who would be responsible to... Go ahead.
Sir, I heard a number of questions, not only the question with regards to liability, but also with regards to how long it may take to clean up a spill. So I think we'd like to address all of those questions to make sure that we have a wholesome response, and I thank you for the opportunity to do so. So first on how we are going to clean up a spill, I'd ask Ms. Heidi Tilquist to answer the question.
Yeah, my name's Heidi Tilquist. I'm a contractor for TransCanada. Just to kind of briefly provide some background about leaks, I mean, first of all, leaks are in nobody's best interest, so, you know, obviously TransCanada has done everything they can to try to prevent leaks, and that includes things like the routing and the manufacturing of the pipe and the depth of the cover, things we talked about earlier. So it's really, in our minds, prevention is really the key. The frequency of an event, of a spill actually happening, is very, very low. For any given mile of pipe, using some conservative assumptions, which means we're overestimating how often we think it might happen, we're estimating that a spill would be no more than once every 7,400 years. So it's quite an infrequent event. However, if it did happen, and if it did get into a river, what would happen then? There's a number of leak detection systems, some of them we talked about, and John can talk about them some more if we need to. TransCanada would detect the leak. Immediately they would implement their emergency response plan. That means they'd have their first responders going out, containing and cleaning up the material. The idea is to limit the downstream dispersion of that oil. There is going to be areas, if oil gets into the water, there is going to be an area that's going to be contaminated by the oil. Oil tends to float on the surface, so the containment booms and things can clean up a lot of the oil. We will be working together with federal and state agencies. Once oil hits water, the EPA, as well as state agencies such as the Department of Environmental and Natural Resources here in South Dakota, all get involved. They're all going to be looking at the cleanup. There's certain standards that are going to have to be met for cleanup. So there's going to be water quality standards. Those standards have to be met to ensure both human health safety, vegetation, so if it was on your crops, whatever. So there's all sorts of standards that have to be met. It's not Keystone that decides those. It's decided in concert with the, again, the state and the federal levels. If in the instance you were suggesting where, you know, if the water is contaminated and it was unusable for a length of time, it would be Keystone's responsibility to provide an alternative water supply for you, for those cattle or whatever your use happened to be. So, liability?
Yes, thanks, Heidi, and I'll get Mr. Jim White to respond to the liability issues.
Thanks. My name is Jim White. I'm a lawyer with TransCanada. Without going into a lot of legal detail, the short answer on liability is that in the event that a leak occurred and a spill resulted and damage resulted from that, the company would be liable and the company would be responsible for the types of damages that you mentioned, including loss of water use, loss of pasture, damage to wells, all of those sorts of damages. Now, there will be an easement agreement in place between the company and individual landowners, and that easement will capture all of the liability provisions. The exceptions could be if the damage were to be caused by an intentional act or some willful misconduct or negligent activity, that would be an exception to the liability provision. But for the most part, in the event that damage occurred, that would be that the company would be liable for that.
So one thing that I didn't quite hear, so maybe we can get an idea, Ms. Tilquist, I mean, give us an idea of what the average size spill has been in this country for crude oil pipelines in recent years, and then how long would it take to clean up a spill of that size? I mean, we're talking days, weeks, months, or years, so that they would know how long this alternate provision of water would need to be going on.
Now, the first question is easy to answer. The second one's a little bit more difficult to answer. Looking at, there's a national database operated by PHMSA. Looking at that, the most recent database, the average, the majority of spills since 2002 have been 3 barrels or less. 3 barrels is about 125 gallons, so about the size of a, you know, one of those large aquariums at your dentist's office. So they're typically fairly small. How long does it take to clean up? It really depends on what type of environment does it go into. If it's in a pump station and it's in a graveled area, it's not going to take very long at all. If it's in some soils, again, probably not very long at all. If it gets into some water and is transported, you might have some vegetation that gets impacted. The water skimming probably won't be that much of an impact. And again, we're talking, you know, it's going to be a matter of hours to contain it, but the impacts are not going to be very long. The last scenario I can think of might be, say, like a wetland. What happens in a wetland, again, it'll disperse across the water surface. Again, Keystone is not going to be deciding how to remediate these things in isolation. They'll be working with the federal and state agencies. In that case, they'll be working, like, say, with the DENR. They may decide to, again, remove the vegetation, remove the soils. They may say, you know, there's this wetland is in isolation. It's not affecting anything else. It may be best to leave it in place. So that may take, you know, there's no time limit on that. It would naturally disperse with time. So it depends on how it's remediated. But most cases for small spill, we're talking a few hours just to remove the material and get it out of the area. Does that help you?
Yeah, it does. Thank you. Other questions?
Yeah. My name is Peter Larson. I'm a geologist and paleontologist with Black Hills Institute in Hill City, South Dakota. And one of the issues, I have two things. One is an issue that I'd like to express to you guys, and the second one is a clarification that I'd like to do after I do this issue, if that's all right. My main issue is dealing with paleontology, dealing with fossils, dealing with the wonderful fossils that we have here in Harding County. And this is one of the truly unique areas in the world where we have the KT boundary, that area of the that time of the extinction of the dinosaurs, and extinction of about 70% of life on this planet occurred right at that point in history. It's a wonderful opportunity for scientists to study global climate change, to study missing faunas, to understand how evolution works, just a really wonderful opportunity. And it's an area that I and my colleagues have been working on for a long time. I personally have been working in Harding County now for about 17 years. And we have some very significant historic as well as prehistoric, I mean really prehistoric, 65.5 million year old sites. But the second most complete Tyrannosaurus rex was found here. The pipeline actually cuts right through three T-Rex sites in one ranch in a very small area. I've got comments that I'd like to pass out to you after I'm done with this that I sent to the Secretary of State's office, or to the, sorry, the Secretary of State's office, and we were commenting here the last month or so ago. Anyway, it's of very prime importance to not only to research, but also to the public in general. And in fact, it's so important that Congress has just enacted a new law, which tacked onto the appropriations bill. It's been assigned by the President, and the Congress, both houses of Congress, have passed it. And it makes the destruction or damage, even unintentional damage, a felony on public lands. That doesn't mean that fossils found on public lands are any more important than fossils found on private lands. And in fact, the fossils found on private lands can sometimes be a source of income to ranchers, which can help them stay in business. And it's one of the things that Harding County has really going for it, that's something very, very important. And I want you guys to consider the importance of this and what you're doing by cutting through some of this area. Now, you see the size of those machines, that big backhoe, that wheeled ditcher, there's no way you're going to see a fossil until you see a couple little crumbs of it maybe coming out behind the machine. You know, I don't care how diligent you are, you're going to destroy fossils, and you're going to destroy potentially not only important scientific fossils, but something that could have been an income for those landowners that should be considered. I'll hand this thing, and you can get it gives you a better idea of what I'm talking about. Also, all of the environmental concerns, there's tons of them. When we're looking at this. Now, the clarification I'd like to make is Mr. Jones has mentioned that it's just like the crude of Saudi Arabia or Venezuela, but that's not quite right because it's what's called syncrude. It's synthetic crude oil because it is taken from the tar sands. It's mixed now, correct me if I'm wrong, mixed with natural gas and chemicals to allow it to flow through a pipe. Also heated, and I understand between 90 and 120 degrees Celsius. Is that Celsius or Fahrenheit?
Sir, you've got a number of questions. I'll be prepared to answer them in order.
Okay, my understanding is that it was 90. The oil has to be heated to 90 to 100 degrees Celsius, which is 250 degrees Fahrenheit. If I'm mistaken about that, please correct me. And it is going through this pipeline at almost 1,500 PSI. Now, to give you an idea of how much pressure that is, the largest measured bite force of a T-Rex is only twice that much. So that's measured on fossil bone, and we can know how much it is. But that's a very high pressure pipeline. It's not like normal pressure of a pipeline. It's much elevated, and also the temperature of the pipeline is elevated, which we worry about leaking into the soils and then destroying the grass, even if it is put back on the surface. And I guess that's close enough for being done. Sorry.
Thank you very much. I believe this is a great opportunity for us to respond to four questions that the gentleman had. Paleontology, the syncrude and crude discussion with regards to the oil sands, the temperature of the oil in the pipeline, and the pressure.
So I think those are the four questions that we'd like to answer. So we'll do them in order. For paleontology, I'll ask Mr. John Schmidt to respond to that question.
Thanks. Stand up. My name is John Schmidt. I'm a contractor with TransCanada. You're right about the paleontology. As you know, the state laws don't require construction projects other than on public lands, state and federal lands, to do paleontological surveys. What TransCanada did and Keystone did is they hired a firm that does cultural resources as well as paleontological studies. Because of the work they had to do on BLM land, they did an assessment of paleontological resource areas in Montana and North and South Dakota. And that all that information, as you indicated, was sent to the Department of State. Department of State's reviewing that with their obligations under federal law. It's also gone to the State Historic Preservation Officer. They'll tell us what we have to do. One thing Keystone has made a commitment to do is implement a paleontological mitigation plan. So whatever the agencies feed back to us, we're obligated to carry out. That'll be a condition of our, you know, we got a myriad of permits we have to get. So that kind of thing will be put into that. Now, will the public review those? You'll have to ask the Department of State. I don't know how they're going to, you know, implement that kind of openness in that document development.
One of my worries is that paleontology, unlike archaeology, which is very much limited to the surface, paleontology goes all the way to the bone, so to speak. I mean,
sure.
No matter how deep you dig in the Hell Creek Formation, you're going to be digging through and destroying fossils.
Sure. Yeah.
And so you can't just look at the surface.
Oh,
and say what's there.
No, a lot of the research that was done, in fact, the testing that was done in federal lands had cores and development. And even in the cultural resource work, we have to take cores at rivers and so forth. It's not surface testing. We have to go down as deep as the ditch goes. So,
a core is not going to tell you where a dinosaur skeleton is buried. You can get it within a millimeter of it and miss
sure.
it. And if you hit it, you've already screwed it up. So,
Mr. Larson, let's go ahead and let the applicant answer all your questions. Then we'll give you back the mic and we'll see if you have any follow-ups. We want to make sure we get everything answered.
So the methodologies were directed to us by the federal and state agencies. So, you know, we're doing what we're told to do. And as like I said, there'll be a paleontological mitigation plan developed. Whatever measures they give us to implement, that's what we'll be following.
Thank you, John. Now I'd like to clarify the question with regards to Syncrude and the fact that that they add chemicals to the Syncrude. Oil sands crude can come in two different forms. You either can come in a form of what they call a synthetic crude, as the gentleman described. Now what that is they've taken the bitumen off the sand and they've refined it. And just like they would refine it for gasoline or for diesel. And that is called synthetic crude. And it tends to compete in the marketplace with a WTI equivalent or a sweet crude. Now, there's also crude what they call WCS. This is a heavy crude. And what they do is they take that bitumen and they either blend it with condensate or they blend it with synthetic crude. And we call that dilbit or synbit. It has similar properties as the crude locations in the world because it's going to the same refineries. In other words, it has to meet the refinery specifications, and that's why I was trying to give you the analogy, because it's going into exactly the same refineries that today get the crude oil from either Venezuela. So the Orinoco crude is a very, very heavy crude in Venezuela, or Saudi heavy. So it's got lots of bitumen type properties and requires a coker in order to break it down. So hopefully that clarifies the crude question. As for temperature, we don't heat the crude oil. The oil changes temperature depending on the season. In the summer, obviously, the oil is going to be hotter than it would be in the wintertime. The oil increases in temperature as it goes through a pump. So as it goes through different pumps, it starts to build up in temperature. We estimate the temperature in the oil to be in South Dakota somewhere between 80 and, I think, 120 degrees max Fahrenheit, not Celsius, Fahrenheit. And remember, that's oil within the steel of the pipe, 4 feet below the ground. So the impact is, what is the temperature bulb as it leaves the pipe? And it's when we did this study in the first project, we found that it had no impact on crops when it came to that project. We're going to do exactly the same study to confirm that with the Keystone XL project.
So then that leaves the pressure, and I think I'll ask Ms. Cathari to answer that question.
So I think I heard the comment was that the pipeline will be transporting the oil at high pressure. With pipeline design, carbon steel pipeline design, pipelines fall into four pressure classes. We are an ANSI 600 pressure class pipeline. The pipeline operating pressure will be 1440 PSI generally at certain locations downstream of the pump station as a result of hydraulic head and elevation. The operating pressure may go as high as 1600 PSI. It will not operate at all times. It's strictly due to hydraulic head. The length of pipe downstream of the pump stations that could see this particular pressure would be varying between 1/10 of a mile to about 4 miles downstream. But generally, the pipeline pressure is 1440 PSI.
And I want to just correct this description that the gentleman described, and that was that this was a very rare occurrence. It's not. ANSI 600 pipelines is the standard. And so, for example, the Northern Border Pipeline that we've operated here for over 20 years is ANSI 600 standard. So it's the same pressure you'd have in any of the major natural gas or any of the major crude oil pipelines.
Okay, Mr. Larson, what did we miss? What do we need to make sure they answer?
Well, I'm still a little confused that this pressure is normal for all pipelines. I think that might be a misstatement.
It's standard for large diameter transmission pipelines, natural gas and liquid pipelines. It's an industry standard.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Larson. Other questions? And again, we're going to take comments here, comments or questions. What we want to do is we want to start with shorter comments so that if people have got things to do, they can make a brief statement and go. So if you've got a comment that's going to last longer than about 2 minutes, let's hold you and let's get the short people done first. Okay, comments or questions of a shorter nature.
Mary Tarter, T-A-R-T-E-R. I'm from Camp Crook, South Dakota. I would like you to explain to us how you plan to not spread noxious weeds on this pipeline.
Thank you. Excellent question. Noxious weeds will be answered by John Schmidt.
So part of the suite of surveys that Keystone has to conduct, they started some last year, and they'll be continuing those this year and all the way up to construction. One of them was identification of potential weed locations. The state gave us a list of species by county. The NRCS gave us a list. The federal government gives us a list as well. Those areas will be identified, and then the noxious weed plan has to be developed and approved by the Department of Agriculture and the NRCS before construction begins. So that any areas that are identified with existing weeds, they'll have to address that with a construction spread and how the equipment moves through that area, how it's cleaned, preventing spread of noxious weeds. Remember, the company is in the long term responsible for the restoration of the right-of-way across your property. That includes monitoring the actual revegetation of the areas, controlling of the weeds. If weeds do get introduced, they have to remediate that issue through the long term. So that'll all be part of the noxious weed plan that they have to develop as well. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Hello, Robert Johnson, J-O-H-N-S-O-N. My question, and I guess I hadn't, it kind of relates to what Linda Gilbert had as far as the county roads and stuff and how you deal with that. And that's great to have a bond. I guess I would hope that some of you will meet with the local governments in order for us to get a plan together to be able to use the roads in a proper way, and that we can probably help you with a plan as far as getting the pipe back and forth without damaging the roads any. At least we can. Thank you.
Yes, we really do need your help. As far as this transportation plan is concerned, what we want to do is we're going to talk about where the pipe's going to be coming in from, and transportation from the rail, local from the rail siding. What, you know, how those trucks will get you know, go through Harding County and get to the rail siding, and we'll sit down and talk about that, make sure that, we have a good clear-cut path, talk about what might need to be done to some of the roads, the turnouts, as the gentleman mentioned earlier, and then taking pipe from those pipe yards to the right-of-way during designated paths, talk about what those paths are, what we need to do to make sure that those roads are such to where we can do that, and then the return trip back. This is a very iterative, ongoing process. We want to work with you on that, too. The maintenance of the roads during construction, work with you and work with our construction contractor on that. And then, for example, if there were a contractor yard here in the county or a pump station site or something like that, how the workers get to and from that. You know, it's a traffic plan. It's a transportation plan. It's what we need to do to make sure that we can do those things. It's posted speeds. It's dust control. It's all of these different things. And you're right. We need to do that hand in hand, working with you, to be able to get that accomplished.
I believe Mr. Myers also has some additional points to make.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Neil Myers, and I'm the vice president of the XL Pipeline Project. Just two quick comments on roads. And first one is that, as John has mentioned, it's not just a matter of repairing any damage that we do. It may be very likely that we actually have to improve some of the roads necessary, and we'll do a transportation survey in conjunction with the county beforehand to understand where we're going and what improvements need to be made, and that may include approaches, as the gentleman mentioned. But just one thing that you may not understand, the trucks that carry the pipe to the right-of-way are called stringing trucks. They're a very specialized piece of equipment that have a steering rear end, so that as they make a turn, this rear end actually turns, and so it makes a very broad turn. So it can actually get around a corner that has a very narrow approach road on it that, say, a semi-truck couldn't get around, but a stringing truck can get around that quite easily. And we bring those trucks here and use those so that we can get around on roads without having to make an awful lot of improvements. Thank you.
Robert, we get you taken care of?
Yes.
Okay, great, thanks. Other questions or comments? Yeah.
Bob, you mentioned aerial surveillance. What does that entail? How often, how high, what will they be flying?
Thank you. Aerial surveillance is a requirement under the Pipeline Safety Division of Department of Transportation, being PHMSA. The requirement is to do aerial patrol 26 times a year and not to exceed 3 weeks. Obviously, if there's bad weather and the aircraft is flying over the line, can't fly over the line, because we are really, really concerned about the safety of our people. We use a fixed-wing aircraft. We find that that's has the most efficient way of doing it. The noise tends to be far better than if you were to use a helicopter. Now, we do use helicopter during construction, and we'll be respectful with regards to the height at which they are working. But obviously, when the crew's there, then we're going to have to manage where the cattle and the livestock are on an individual basis. But during the operation of the pipeline, we use a fixed wing aircraft. Mr. Hayes also has a supplement to that question.
Ms. Trask, an audience, just to let you know on the aerial surveillance, it's not just us picking a pilot randomly. These pilots that we pick, we train them specifically in noticing any differences or anomalies in the right-of-way. Those things might include any erosion, any encroachment on the right-of-way, anything at all like oil staining, looking at leaks if we have them, and any other thing that's just out of the ordinary that they might notice. When a pilot does see something, he immediately radios down to our ground people, and they respond to whatever that anomaly may be that they see in the ground.
And just for the record, Stephanie Trask had asked the question. This is just for our audio record, Stephanie. Stephanie Trask. It'll be transcribed later. And just for a note, even if you speak two or three different times, please just state your name again. And then when this audio tape is transcribed, the person will know who's speaking.
Brett Clanton again.
I was wondering if somebody could touch on the subject of the three-phase transmission lines that will encroach upon us, where they're going to be, what that's all going to entail.
I'll ask Mr. Myers to respond to the electrical grid question.
Thank you for the question. Yes, so we use exclusively electrically powered pumps to move the oil through the line. The number of pumps at the station will vary between 3 to 5, depending on the throughput that we're having at the time. As Mr. Jones said earlier, we'll start out with 700,000 barrels a day. That's 3 pumps, and we'll expand eventually to 900,000 barrels a day, and that requires 5 pumps. So we do have to bring high voltage power into every pump station. We are in the process of working with all of the utilities that will supply power to the pump stations along the entire route from the border right down through to Texas to determine the connection point, the routing, the preferred routing, et cetera. And there is a process that they have to follow to get the permit to build all of those lines as well, and we'll be working with landowners on the routing of those lines.
How long before affected landowners would know if they're being impacted by this? What time frame? When will that be?
And so just so I'm clear, do you mean impacted by knowing if there'll be a pump station located potentially on property that you own, or that a transmission line may cross a piece of property that you own?
Both.
Oh, okay. Well, we're getting very close to finalizing the locations of the pipes, the pumping stations. They're always subject to a bit of change. Sometimes when we meet with landowners, we realize there's some things that we didn't think about, and we'll make some small adjustments. So I think those are pretty close. And land agents will be coming out actually very shortly to talk to landowners both about the easement but also about the purchase of the pump station sites. A typical pump station is about 5 to 8 acres in size, and we purchase that from the landowner, and we take ownership of that property. It becomes ours. And then the second is on the routing. I'm not exactly sure. I think it'll be a little while yet. Different utilities go through different number of alternatives that they have to look at to bringing power to the site. And sometimes the bringing the power to the site is not just for us, it's for other electrical needs that utility may have, and we have no knowledge or influence on what they're doing just to maintain and grow and expand their system. So it's a difficult question for me to answer with specificity, because they are doing things that just really aren't affected by us. But in order to get this done on time, so we want to go in service in 2012, it's going to happen soon, where it'll be notified, because it takes that long to get permission and to build the lines.
Well, I was just wondering, because there will be affected property owners that are going to completely miss these permitting processes that we're going through right now.
The answer to that is, if it crosses your land, you'll know.
Yeah, I'm Tom Costello again. We were contacted for one of those transmission lines, and my question, maybe you can't answer it, but I've been understood that our local cooperative is pretty taxed for the amount of electricity they're getting now to supply the oil field in our county, and I was wondering if this transmission line that is coming through is going to be a positive for our cooperative, or if it's going to be a negative for our cooperative. And they didn't have an idea where the line was coming from, if it's their own source that is going to supply it, or if they're going to bring a source in from somewhere else. And I was wondering, just kind of curious, if it's going to impact our local cooperative where it's good for our county.
Maybe we'll head the applicant off at the pass and look to the subject matter expert in the audience. Mr. Eisenhower, do you want to pop up? And before you guys think I sold Jerry out, I looked at him first. Yeah.
This should be interesting.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm 50 miles from home.
didn't bring a briefcase, so I am not an expert. But the impact, and I will also address Brett Clanton's question. I am Jerry Reisenauer. I'm the general manager of Grand Electric Cooperative in Bison. We are going to serve three of the pump stations on the TransCanada pipeline. We're going to, as it's projected today, we're going to build about 80 miles of 115,000 volt line and three substations for these pumping loads. Total investment is going to be somewhere around $30 million. Huge investment to serve the pipeline. Is it positive? We expect it will be. We've made projections on the kilowatt hours the pipelines will use. We're looking at a startup projection of about 75 million kilowatt hours per year per pump station. We're looking at full load of about 140 million kilowatt hours per pump station per year. If you start doing the math on that, you're talking about 450 million kilowatt hours. You start adding a few mills, power cost or O&M and that type of thing to it, brings in a lot of dollars and there's some revenue associated with it. The siting of the pipeline or the pump stations and the transmission lines is not complete. We are working with Western Area Power as to where we will interconnect with their system, and as that's approved, we will know more about the siting. We are starting to contact the landowners to talk to the landowners about obtaining permission to do an environmental study and to do some study on placement of the pipeline, and we're certainly open and interested in what our members have to say on location. It will be a huge project. We're looking to start the project in 2010, be completed by 2012. It will go fast. So once we get going, there will be a lot of activity in the area.
Brett Clanton, the construction, is it a bid process for the construction of the lines?
That would depend upon two things, Brett. First off, how the construction or how the construction is financed. If we are financing any portion of the construction, the Rural Utilities Service, our banker, will require that it's a bid process. If it is a financed by TransCanada, that changed some of the rules that we will operate under. But I would fully expect two things. First off, that TransCanada is going to look at us and say, how can you assure us that we're spending our money wisely, and that is going to be through a bid process. And secondly, it's probably going to entail more than one contractor when you're talking 80 or more than 80 miles of construction over a two-year period.
And I don't mind if we get into some more depth on this, but because it's a little bit off topic, let's come back to it if we have time at the end here. So as much as I like seeing you sweat, Jerry, let's see if we've got other comments or questions on the... We'll come back and have a hearing just for Jerry some night.
Yes, I'm Mike Cantrell, C-A-N-T-R-E-L-L, M-I-K-E. I'm the president of the Domestic Energy Producers Alliance based in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And the question was sort of asked earlier about the impact on American crude markets by this pipeline, and I must say it most effectively dodged. And I'm hoping that since the question was asked the first time, I can restate the question and perhaps the vice president or someone can address our concerns a little bit. We've seen the differentials for U.S. domestic crude change dramatically in the negative as Canadian crude has found its way into our market. First into the Guernsey market, we saw a $25 differential, a drop in the price of crude when that oil hit the Guernsey market a few years ago. And now, just this year, we've seen a dramatic drop in at Cushing, as much as a $14 differential, as much as $17 for producers in Kansas. And, you know, it seems to us that the question is one that we're bringing a lot of crude into a marketplace that's already pretty full. It seems to me that the cart's ahead of the horse. They should have built the line to from Cushing to Houston first to have takeaway capacity to get it to the Gulf Coast, where there's plenty of refining capacity to handle that heavy crude, not in the mid-continent where there's really not. So what's happened at Cushing in this last 6 months or last two or three months is that the Cushing, Oklahoma, has the largest above-ground storage of crude in the world. So everybody tries to get their oil to Cushing, especially in a market condition called contango, when the price is bigger in the out months and they want to store their crude. It just seems to me that, and in the initial reports we've heard or read about the pipelines, that both pipelines, Keystone and Keystone XL, were not going to accept any domestic crude. It was just going to be full of Canadian crude. I'm glad to hear a departure from that tonight for the first time, and I'm interested in hearing more about the potential capacity for American crude to be going into lines across America. That seems kind of commonsensical to me. it seems to me that if we're going to cross the United States of American soil, and we're going to go through sensitive ecological, paleontological areas, and if we're going to disrupt valuable farmland and valuable land, and the public purpose is a real important part of this. Now, I understand tax revenue. That's a great thing, elevating tax revenue and causing local economies not to have the burden of full taxation that they've had in the past because of that. I understand that. But my question is sort of like the people along that line that are mineral owners. I mean, we represent thousands of mineral owners across the lower 48 in America. And when they see their price disadvantaged, and what we're afraid of is when 1.5 million barrels hits Cushing, or 600,000 with this pipeline, as we understand, and then another million or so with the XL, the one you're talking about here today, we're concerned that there may not even be a market for U.S. domestic crude with so much coming from one place into a marketplace that's already saturated. So I just want to throw out that concern, and hopefully I can hear something about that that'll make us feel a lot easier about it, because there's going to be a tremendous cost to citizens of this country with the pipeline coming through at 1,550 pounds PSI, and I promise you, I've been in the business my whole life, and that's not a three-barrel spill. If you have an accident at 1,550 PSI, I don't care how fast you get to it. It's not a three-barrel spill. So it's a serious consequence to all of us. And to see the value of our
Sir,
minerals.
Sir, I don't want to cut you short, but
yeah,
let's get to a question. Let's have him answer it. And if we need a follow-up for
sure.
2 or 10, then we'll get to her.
That's fine. I think I've said enough. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And I guess you're going to test my limited knowledge of crude oil pricing in the United States. This pipeline has contracts committed of 910,000 barrels. And these are contracts that were signed by U.S. refiners. So the U.S. refining and marketing community is supporting the project with huge contracts. These are contracts on an average of 18 years. So the demonstration of the need, the public need, was certainly very well captured by the fact that they signed these contracts. Now, this country consumes 20 million barrels a day on average. And three-quarters of that comes from offshore sources. I mean, it comes from Middle Eastern sources, Mexican sources, and Venezuelan sources. And the companies that are signing these contracts are looking to displace those sources. They're not looking to replace U.S. sources, not at all. I mean, the fact of the matter is that these refineries today take crude from offshore, and then they're going to take crude from Canada. So for me, the math isn't anything to do with local domestic production. There is all sorts of little dynamics within the United States, no question about that, and it has to do with the type of crude, the refineries nearby, what those refineries take, the pipeline capacity issues at the time. But, you know, these things change. Every season they change, the price changes with regards to what the demands are. Diesel all of a sudden is in big demand, so what crude type help with diesel production? If there's a hurricane in the Gulf Coast, then all of a sudden the other Chicago refineries, the price of crude goes up. I mean, there's just so many dynamics to the change in crude price that to pin it on a pipeline is not to look at the big picture. Now, there's this pipeline is refineries in the Gulf Coast that need to use crude from a different source. Hopefully that is a reasonable answer.
Well, actually, this pipeline is scheduled to be done in 2012, correct? The very first pipeline is scheduled to be done this year. That oil is not going to the Gulf Coast refineries. It's going to Cushing.
No, it's not, sir. It's going to Wood River, Illinois. There's 440,000 barrel a day refinery in Wood River today that takes crude from the Gulf up and is going to displace that with Canadian crude.
Well, that's all fine and good, except the reality is that we've seen our price go down. And we know ConocoPhillips, for example, is a half owner in this pipeline. And ConocoPhillips, right? Isn't that correct?
So if you're asking me a question, sir, the question is...
Yeah, my question is, let me finish. I got to kind of interrupt it. The question is that ConocoPhillips has at least three refineries that you're talking about. And the idea that they can bring in a large source of crude that they own in another country and displace domestic crude and get a $25 a barrel better price at the expense of American producers and American royalty owners and mineral owners and landowners just doesn't seem quite fair to me. And so, and the 75% is not exactly right. We don't import 75%. By the time you add natural gas liquids, it's closer to 60. So.
Well, and sir, it's not that I don't think your issues are of concern, but I do want to focus on landowner concerns and issues that people from the area have because, you know, we'd be happy to meet with you and Pierre or hear the comments after the fact. What's that? They may, but let's go ahead and hear from them and make sure the applicants got an opportunity to hear those questions as well. Go ahead, ma'am.
What my question is why did ConocoPhillips, Deborah Niemi, N-I-E-M-I, why did ConocoPhillips drop their interest in it? And also, re-explain the financing for the infrastructure of this pipeline, just because I believe it'll cost you more than what you stated before.
Thank you for that question, because it does give us a chance to correct the statement made that ConocoPhillips owns 50% of the project. ConocoPhillips is a minority owner of the project. Originally, they were a 50-50 partner. Last year, they chose to reduce their ownership to 20%. They did that strategically, but for me to explain, I don't represent ConocoPhillips. I represent TransCanada. I can tell you that ConocoPhillips is a joint venture partner in dozens of pipelines. So this is a common thing for them to be in partnership all over pipelines throughout North America. As for how we're going to finance the project, you know, TransCanada has an A-grade credit. Standard & Poor's out of New York has just been through our office, and in fact, I met with them last Friday. We continue to maintain an A-grade credit. And in this economic downturn, we've been able to raise $2 billion in the last quarter. So when nobody else could get money, because we're a utility, we were still be able to raise this money. So we issued $1 billion worth of equity, and it was over even more than we anticipated, and we were able to also achieve $1 billion worth of financing. So you know, we're a large corporation, $40 billion in assets, A-grade credit, and huge capability to acquire financing.
Also, Deborah Niemi again. Was that through the bond offering through HSBC? Were those bonds sold through, was it HSBC Holdings? Who were they sold to, the $2
billion? To get into some of the details on the financing, we sell it to a consortium of banks, and then they resell it to a number of folks. So from a TransCanada perspective, we were oversubscribed. So we were really, really pleased with how well the financing went.
I think she asked, was that through HSBC?
It was through a consortium of banks. Okay. So that's just one bank. There's quite a few. Oh, lots of banks. But ma'am, I don't know. I can't recall all of them. I can tell you that from our perspective, the consortium of banks bid out the bonds, and they oversubscribed for them. So for our perspective, the banks have got the bonds, and when they're carrying them, and then they resell them to different owners. So we're very pleased with the way it went.
Brett Clanton again, and Dusty, as a landowner, me impacted by this pipeline, Mike has my permission to talk all night.
Good, fair enough. Well, Mr. Clanton, we've heard you. We'll hand the microphone back to Mike. Mike, if you've got another follow-up question, we'd be happy to hear it.
Oh, I would like to elaborate on the first answer, the first question. The first time I've heard anyone from TransCanada say that you were in negotiations to handle domestic crude oil in the pipeline. Did I hear that right?
I can say that we've been in discussions with them. They're confidential discussions, so I can't get into the details. But I can tell you that for all the producers that are here, that it's really between, you know, it doesn't make sense for the market to do that. We're working with a group of them right now. I think you might have seen an article last week that the North Dakota Pipeline Authority has been doing some research, and we were cooperating with them. So, you know, there certainly is the optionality there. I think fundamentally, though, the real benefit is that we're moving that crude off the existing lines that are congested, and that's going to free up a lot of pipeline capacity that today is causing some of that localized netback issues that you talk about. You talked about.
Mr. Cantrell, anything else? All right. Brett, anything else? All right, sounds good. Other questions, other comments?
In the back. Tom Costello again. I have a question as far as the pipeline going through us. How is that going to affect our exploration for gas or oil on our own property? I guess if you need clarification, I'm just wondering, are we going to be limited to where we can explore?
Thank you.
With the line going through us?
I appreciate your clarification. I was struggling with it. As you know, that we're asking for a 50-foot permanent easement and a 65-foot additional 65-foot temporary easement, and that may change depending on the soil conditions. But if you were, for example, needed to drill the same year we were doing construction, then obviously the restriction on the drilling would be the 110 feet. Ultimately, you can't do anything within that 50 feet because we got to ensure the safety of the pipeline. So you can't, like, put the drilling rig right over top and start drilling for oil or gas. But I certainly think, you know, a 50... yeah, you'd probably find quite a bit. Maybe I shouldn't have put that idea in your mind. No. But you certainly, you know, certainly I don't think that 50-foot strip is going to, you know, impact the a potential drilling rig operation. It would have to be adjacent to it, and we'd obviously be very... I want to work with you with regards to crossing the line so that we put some extra padding over the line to make sure that there was no additional load factor problems with regards to that.
Would that be the same for, like, seismograph exploration and that type?
That's correct, yep.
Okay.
Yeah, this is for the Matt Gilbert, G-I-L-B-E-R-T. This is for the PUC, and I don't even know if you can answer my question, but the lawyer right off the bat, and I forget which lawyer it was, said that all this money stays in Harding County, and I'm pretty sure we know that's not true. I mean, he can't guarantee that. I'm a landowner in Harding County, and I'm also on the school board, and for what I read, this has a potential to hurt the school district as much as it helps it. I mean, for the money that we take in, the state can take it away as far as the school district goes, even affecting things such as sparsity. I was just wondering if you guys have any plans on showing us, you know, we're bringing all this money and we're the ones that have to put up with all the extra traffic, the land displacement, all the activity. What guarantee do we have that we're going to actually see any of this money that Mr. Lawyer said that we're going to stay in Harding County, which we all know once it gets to Pier, it has a hard time getting back. And I was just wondering if you have any plan that you can show us that before it actually happens.
Well, Mr. Gilbert, I'll be very honest with you. We're not tax experts, and that would be the Department of Revenue and Regulation that would ultimately verify that the tax receipts, you know, are being done properly, as well as county officials. You know, speak any further than that, I'll be honest with you, you're probably pretty far outside our area of expertise. If it's all right with you, I mean, I'd maybe ask the applicant to have Mr. Taylor respond to your issues and see if he can make all of us feel a little more comfortable with your concerns.
Well, maybe if the CSRS that said it stayed in Harding County, whichever person that was, can explain how that's going to happen when these guys don't even know where it's going to go, because it has to go through the central state government before it even gets allocated.
And I'm glad to know I'm not the only one who gets confused by which lawyer is which sometimes. So, Go ahead. Mr. Jones, if it's all right with you, we'd have Mr. Taylor.
Absolutely. Commissioner Bill? Make a seat.
I had my back to the audience. Who am I talking to? Let me help you remember who I am. I'm the old guy in this bunch. I'll tell you the answer to your question, what money stays here, what goes to peers, real simple. And it's already answered. It's in the South Dakota Code, and the South Dakota Code says this. It says the Department of Revenue will figure out what the value of the pipeline is. Now, I'm going to tell you why it says that. It's a history question. When the railroads were built across South Dakota, every county said, I'm going to have a special assessment on this railroad so that the railroad will pay most of the taxes in my county. And in the 1890s, there was a statute passed that said all utility properties are assessed, their values determined by the Department of Revenue. Once a year, the Department of Revenue figures out what the value is, and they send the information to the local assessor. When your county and your school board do their budgets and figure out their mill levies, they use that value to figure out what's going to be taxed against the pipeline. The same question came up in Philip last night, and I don't know where this information's coming from. So I called my office today and had them go back through the code and tell me, does the pipeline company get one bill from PIER for real estate taxes throughout the state? The answer is no. It gets a bill from Harding County, and it writes a check to Harding County. The money comes to Harding County, stays in Harding County. That simple. Now, your legislators, some of them are here tonight. There was one sitting right here just a minute ago.
The other one's right here.
Let me borrow a term out of your vernacular. You need to get a dally on them and make sure that they don't change the statutes. The pipeline company can't control that. The voters control that. The system of law, the way our system of taxation works right now, has been virtually unchanged as long as I can remember, and I've been practicing law in South Dakota for 37 and a half years. Does that answer your question?
Mr. Gilbert, that's a really good point. Let's make sure we get you a mic so that we can have that on the record. What's that?
Matt Gilbert, spelled the same. My concern was we don't get our oil impact money once it goes to beer back like was designed to, and we're the ones that have to put up with the oil field and everything that goes along with that, and some of us aren't so lucky to have all the mineral rights or all that kind of business. But my concern is that this pipeline will fall under the same sort of jurisdiction, that we won't get that impact money back, such as we don't with the oil impact money.
That's a severance taxes are a whole different story. Completely different scheme of things. I'm talking about real estate taxes. Severance taxes, if you want to know the history about that, talk to me at the break, and I'll tell you how it all started with Homestake.
So this falls under a completely different thing than oil severance?
Completely different deal.
Can I have your card to make sure in case something goes wrong I can call you?
Absolutely. I'll get it for you right now.
All right. I know we got a lot of other questions. It's about time for a quick break. Let's go ahead. Well, we'll give the Honorable Senator a chance to...
The question that he's going after, my name is Ryan Maher, M-A-H-E-R, and I serve as the District 28 State Senator. And the question that needs to be answered is with this property tax revenue is how it affects the Cutler-Gabriel. I mean, with local revenue... You know, that's usually a 48-52 split, that as your local effort goes up, and if this money falls into your local effort, then your state aid decreases. So it's really not a tax benefit, it's just a tax shift. And so that's the question that needs to be answered, is how does this oil revenue money affect Cutler-Gabriel? If that happens, the other question that falls into play here is if this money is all coming into Harding County, they lose on a sparsity. And if they drop on a sparsity, Then they fall under the, if their enrollment drops, then they lose, they run into the situation of having to force their school to close, like what happened over at Condi. Condi was a situation where they had a pipeline in that district. They received approximately $20,000 a year in state aid and only had 50 students in that school. They received almost zero taxpayer dollars. That money was all generated in the Condi school district by local effort. Therefore, they received very little state aid. That very same situation could happen here, and these people should have their question answered as to how this oil revenue and from the pipeline is going to affect local effort in the relationship to the Cutler-Gabriel Amendment in the education formula.
Do I know the answer?
Sure.
It's going to double local effort.
So then their state aid revenue is going to drop.
Stay put. I'll tell you exactly what's going to happen to your state aid. Based on the work we did in 2000, using 2008 as a model year, there will be no foundation state aid paid to Harding County, South Dakota.
So it's a tax shift.
No, it's not a tax shift. I'll tell you what it is. The money that you get in foundation state aid from PEER doesn't come from Mars. It comes from the taxpayers of South Dakota. The theory is that small schools in areas that have an inability from the value of their real estate to support education deserve to have money paid from them by the state. You know, I live in Sioux Falls. Everybody says you people in Sioux Falls are rich because you got all those fancy buildings and businesses. You have a big tax base. What's going to happen in Harding County is, as I said in the very beginning, your tax base is going to go from 155 to into the middle 300s. We're going to double your tax base. Bear in mind that more than half of the responsibility for that double tax base is a consequence of the construction of the pipeline. And the pipeline company will be paying real estate taxes on that. Now, you probably know this because it sounds to me like you know how the school aid formula works. You also need to know that the pipeline is classified for school tax purposes as a utility. And the utility bears a financial responsibility for taxes almost double what agricultural property bears with respect to education. And that's going to happen right here in this county. You're not going to get any foundation state aid, but you're going to get the money plus a whole lot more from the pipeline company.
So, Mr. Taylor, let's bring it down to the bottom line, though, and that is after you adjust for the lost revenue from the state because of the Cutler-Gabriel that Senator Meyer's talking about, is there any net taxation benefit for school districts because of the pipeline? And if so, do you have an approximate figure of what that would be?
Yeah, the net taxation benefit. Well, the cost of education is going to change because of the pipeline. So what is a net taxation benefit? The cost of education is the same. What's going to happen now is the burden of the cost of education is going to be borne 100% by property taxes in this county. And of those property taxes, more than 50% will be paid by the pipeline company. What I did in the study that I worked out is we worked out the entire student aid, the application of the student aid formula in the state of South Dakota in 2008. The legislature appropriates a finite sum of money for student aid, and we refigured the entire state after we took into account the change in assessed valuation or the local effort in Harding County. There's about, the effect of the pipeline statewide is there's about $5.2 million that will not be paid to the counties in state aid as a result of the increased local effort. Now, if that is, as you said, Commissioner Johnson, a change in the taxation scheme, yes, there is a heavier burden placed on the county. But in Harding County, despite that heavier burden being placed on the county, the overall taxes for all of you people who are currently taxpayers in Harding County is going to go down by almost 50%. Almost 50%. What that means is, if you just hang on, if you got a guy, if you're paying $10,000 in real estate taxes today, you're going to pay about $5,000 on that same tract of property when the pipeline is constructed. That's provided you can keep a deli on your legislators. Have I answered your question?
Kind of. The other this is just a comment.
Hold on, Senator Maher, we got to come back to this. We got all kinds of questions on this. If we don't take a break, I'm going to burst. So let's take a short break. I've been squirming. I'll tell you what, we got Senator Maher with the mic. I'm not going to take it. He's my boss, just like you know all you guys are. I'm not going to take it away. Okay, go ahead. You can ask your question.
Those of you who know me know that I have a very special respect for lawyers. but there's one thing bothers me. With all due respect, this man is hired by the company. It's his opinion. It's his opinion. And I think it might behoove the PUC to get the opinion of the Attorney General onto what's going to happen to the taxes. Because it is just an opinion. State law can change, as he mentioned. But even with the state law the way it is today, I think we need to have a clarification from somebody who is in power that actually makes those kinds of decisions. Just a suggestion. My name again is Peter Larson.
Thanks very much, Mr. Larson. And just by way of process clarification, to the extent that you know the applicant enters this sort of information into the record as evidence, then commission staff, as well as any other interveners, will have an opportunity to test that evidence, cross-examine witnesses, and call their own witnesses, exactly to your point, to make sure that it's not just one side's opinion. Point well taken. Okay. With that, let's go ahead and take, we got to get a break in. I'll say 10, but it's probably going to be 15. The bathroom's not that big, so we'll be back. Oh.
Got a little out of hand there. Well, got a little out of hand there, fellas. Sorry. I don't know how to.
Was it with you?
Yeah.
All right, let's go ahead and get her started back up. All right. All right, we're going to go ahead and get her started back up. You know, by way of preface, you know, two things. First off, and I sort of made this comment to Mr. Larson, but, you know, what's represented here tonight by any of the folks here or by the applicant, I mean, that's going to get tested. This is really the beginning of the process. Any of the claims are going to be tested, you know, through our regulatory and quasi-judicial process, and we'll just figure out. Anything anybody says, we'll have an opportunity to be cross-examined under oath, and so we'll be able to add to the record in that way. And then we've had a lot of discussion about taxation tonight, and I don't want to minimize that impact because it's a big deal, and when you look at what we're supposed to consider, certainly the economic condition of the inhabitants is one of the factors we're to consider. But it's not the biggest factor. It's not the smallest factor. It's one of a whole series of factors we're supposed to consider, including paleontological resources and the environment and all kinds of socioeconomic well-being items. So just by way of that, what did I miss?
I don't think you missed anything, but I do have some concerns about the way the conversation was going earlier. I don't want anybody to say, well, we had a PUC hearing in Harding County and someone said that our taxes were going to go down 50%. And maybe they didn't because of what maybe a county commissioner or legislatures had done. So I just want to make that differentiation that the application and the information that we're after this evening deals with those four things that Dusty had mentioned at the beginning of the meeting. I don't want to make it sound like it's unimportant, but it is. But the price of oil could go to $300 a barrel, or the price of oil could go to $2 a barrel of oil. Taxes could go up or taxes could go down. Those are all things that are weighed in our decision, but that is not going to be the final decision maker for us. So I just wanted to make that differentiation that you were not promised your taxes will go down tonight. You were not promised that the price of oil will go down or up. There's a lot of different factors that we're going to take into effect.
Well, there were some representations made by the applicant based on 2008 assumptions.
Yes.
But to your point, certainly the legislature does make tweaks to the tax code. So with that, let's take questions and comments. Any questions and any comments?
Yeah, Mike Cantrell again, M-I-K-E. You guys do this every night, and you do a very good job, and this is my very first time, so you'll pardon me for not being quick enough on my feet. But when you talk about congestion in the pipeline now, that this is going to alleviate, the congestion's caused by Canadian crude now. It's not caused by U.S. crude. And we've got 180,000 barrels more crude in our pipeline system now. You're right, that'll alleviate that congestion. But the congestion that matters to price is not the congestion in the pipeline. It's the congestion at Cushing, Oklahoma, where NYMEX prices are figured. And everybody's price from coast to coast, Canada to Mexico, is based on NYMEX, West Texas Intermediate at NYMEX, done at Cushing, Oklahoma. And so it's not really accurate to talk like that it's going to alleviate congestion, therefore have no bearing on price. It's just going to put more congestion into a marketplace, not necessarily into any one pipeline or another, but into the marketplace where prices are set at Cushing, Oklahoma. That's just the way NYMEX does it. That's where the prices get done, and that's our concern, that you're flooding a market. Now, we're not going to say that it's because ConocoPhillips owns refineries and they're trying to back down the price of domestic crude for their refineries. I mean, that's a thought that comes to your head, but we're not going to say that. We are just saying that it has a dramatic effect on prices. It's done that, and the people that make the decision here are the people, the landowners that are making their decisions that have minerals and have production, need to know that it's probably going to negatively affect their price if this Canadian crude comes to Cushing, Oklahoma, and stops in that marketplace without going to excess refining capacity. That's all I had to say, and appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Cantrell. Any comments by the applicant?
Oh, Mike, I'd probably love to debate crude oil pricing and crude oil dynamics with you, except for, I am a pipeliner, and certainly we just move the crude oil. We don't own the crude, and we don't refine the crude. However, just to clarify, there's no doubt there's been a negative netback impact as a result of apportionment on other pipelines, whether it be the Enbridge line or the Badger line into Guernsey, as you mentioned. So that's a fact. The other thing that's a fact is that refiners have signed 910,000 barrels worth of contracts because they're worried about supplies from places like Mexico and Venezuela. So that's also a fact. I'll just leave it at that.
All right, other questions or comments? Raise your hand. We can have one more on the on deck. Go ahead, sir.
Darwin Latham, L-A-T-H-A-M, from Camp Crook. And I kind of wanted to go back to an earlier topic. We talked about the local emergency responders. And I think, there's one comment I'd like to make is that they said there'd be an immediate response from the company. And out here we find that, there's no such thing as an immediate response. It's like hours from pretty much anywhere to get here. So that's a concern. But I think the part that the earlier questions are trying to get to is that during the construction phase, you're probably talking an influx of pipeline contractors and all the people working there that's probably going to effectively almost double the population of Harding County while they're here. And all of our local emergency services, from the sheriff's department to the EMS to the fire departments, are going to have to deal with whatever needs that arise from all this extra population. I mean, we're talking a huge increase in traffic, let alone anything else that might happen. So I guess I understand that the county is going to get extra money from property taxes once the pipeline is finished, but this is going to be a large upfront expense to probably cover the situation while construction's going on. And I wondered if there was any consideration of this or what could be done about that situation.
So I'd like to first address some of the construction questions, and I'll have John Phillips here do that. And then on the emergency response question, maybe I'd ask Mr. Hayes to supplement, hopefully be responsive to your question.
Okay, I may need you to repeat the question for me as far as are you concerned about emergency services for the contractor personnel? Is that one of your questions?
Well, it's everybody. I mean, with the amount of extra traffic, yes, the contractor personnel, but also, you know, you're going to have a huge amount of extra traffic. I can see where there's going to be possibly, depending on what time of the year, there's going to be a huge fire concern. There's going to be accidents EMS going to have to respond to, not only on the job site, but we're talking traffic on the roads and other things. And I'm sure if we're going to have a lot of people here that are law enforcement, it's also going to need to be beefed up.
Sir, thank you for that question, because one of the points I wanted to make, and I haven't done so far, is to really represent how important safety is to TransCanada. I mean, it is by far one of the most important things we have to consider. We have to think about the safety of not only our employees and our contractors, but also the public. I can tell you that our safety program is top decile. We make sure our contractors are focused on safety. So that has to do with the transportation plan, with regards to speeding, use of we don't allow cell phones while they're driving. They must wear their safety belts. Protective equipment. It's absolutely mandatory that they wear their personal protective equipment. We are just safety fanatics, and we're proud of it. And so I want to assure you that we are really going to work with our contractors to make sure that they are following our safety guidelines, which, as I said, are top decile.
I sure appreciate that, but you know, I guess you're not going to be riding with them every second of the day, and, you know, you're just bound. We're very safety conscious here in Harding County, too, but there's still accidents, and there's going to be accidents. There's going to be fires. There's going to be things law enforcement needs to be taken care of, and when you're talking about potentially doubling the population of the county, we're just going to have more needs, and I think that needs to be addressed. Thank you.
This is John Hayes again from row two here.
Sorry, Mr. Hayes, hold on just a second. We've got a little talk in the back that we've heard from some folks is making it a little tough to hear back there. So if you've got some sidebar conversations, if you could just step out or over, that'd probably be helpful. Thanks. Go ahead, Mr. Hayes.
Okay, thank you. Once again, John Hayes. Just to answer the question on the company emergency response and what response times we will have. So when we site our pump stations, one of the things we do when we site them and put people there is we are guaranteeing a response to any pipeline anomaly that we see within 4 hours, and hopefully way under 4 hours. The other important part is that we are going to engage your first responders in our training drills as observers, and they will participate in our incident command system training drills that we have. The other point that I think is important, I recently completed the design of emergency response equipment and trailers for the Keystone project. We will be siting a very comprehensive emergency response trailer in this county.
Brett Clanton again, just dwell on that a little bit. Let's be specific. If there's an accident on the job or on the road, is it going to be up to our county EMS to deal with that, or are you going to deal with that? Job site accident.
Job site accident, it would be the county EMS. We would sit down in advance, work with county law enforcement, county service providers, the EMS, have discussions with those people in advance, and talk about how we handle these types of issues, these types of emergencies, who we call, what do we do prior, you know, what What do we do? In addition, as Robert mentioned about the safety, we have site-specific safety plans, hard to say, site-specific safety plans that the contractor has to follow. They generate those safety plans. We have people in the field that monitor those safety plans. But, yes, the answer to your question is county EMS would be the first responders.
My name is Kay Latham, and I'm an EMT. And we are all volunteers. I hope you realize that. And we all work at different jobs. I mean, we are not sitting at home waiting for this. There is times that I'm called at work. I leave work to respond on the ambulance. This is not something that's going to just be like, boom, and this is wonderful. We're talking a serious impact on our emergency medical services. And we are volunteers. We all have other jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we're going to need, we're going to need your help. There's no question that we want to understand the capability, because then we're going to have to look at our contractors to make sure that then they fill in those gaps. So there's no doubt we'll do a gap analysis and determine what additional safety factors that we need to consider. It's not uncommon for large mobile crews like this to have, for example, an EMT on site to work with kind of day-to-day first aid issues. But when it comes to, obviously a major accident, of which, by the way, we have very, very few. Our away from work case rate is below one right now. So, we're very, very proud of our safety record. That being said, I do hear you, that we're going to have to determine if there is a gap considering the work crews that are going to be here. Now, the thing about Harding County, my understanding is that we're going to have one spread per year, and there's about 500 or 600 men and women in a spread.
Hold on, before we go to the next, ma'am, did we get your question answered? Did you have a follow-up? Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
Leonard Nygaard, I was just wondering if you know what kind of cell phone service we have in this area.
Oh, yeah, we do. So I'll have Mr. Myers answer it, because his crews have been working through here, and he understands the challenges.
Yeah, and I'm sitting here, and my cell phone's just a wasted paperweight hanging on my belt right now. So right now we have crews working across about 600 people across the United States. In Montana and in the Dakotas, we're equipping those crews with satellite phones right now as a means of communication, because there are no cell networks in the remote areas. We haven't made final decisions yet, but in this kind of area, it would be very typical for us to install temporary cell phone service ourselves, for ourselves, along the spread. So as John mentioned, a spread is 80 to or so miles long. We would install towers for ourselves during construction, and then we would remove it at the end of construction so that our crews have communication, because that's a very important part of what they do. So that's part of our assessment that we do. What do we need to be able to communicate?
Other questions or comments? Ms. Trask?
Just to add to that, on some of our communications, our operations personnel are looking at probably having sat phones. Also, our pump stations will use redundant satellite communication as well.
Mr. Nygaard, we got you taken care of, right? Good. Yeah, Ms. Trask, go ahead.
Trask. So mine are comments, and they're for the POC. I'm actually here representing Dakota Rural Action, and many of our members are landowners who are affected by the proposal throughout the state. And so if the PUC is sincere about placing conditions and restrictions on the company that will put the people who live and own the land in the communities and drink the water, I'd just like to run through a little list of things that we've come up with in meetings and members have identified that are concerns. First of all, if the emergency response plan is available and ready before the state permit is issued, which you indicated it will be, that needs to
I'm sorry to interrupt. Prior to operation of the permit, prior to operation of the pipeline, not approval of the permit.
Okay, so that would be a condition, that it be approved before the permit, and then that it be widely distributed among the communities along the affected route, and widely available for public review and input, such what we just got from the back of the room. The company mentioned it does not know the expected life of its pipeline. I consider that unacceptable, and I think our landowners would consider the response that the life may end two or three generations down the road, not our problem, also unacceptable. So there needs to be a minimum life established for the pipeline. Reclamation standards should be those of the BLM. Those are widely accepted, I think, reputable standards that landowners could live with. A 100% level 3 cultural and historic assessment, which includes all the paleontological resources and historical and cultural, should be a condition of the permit. That the company use American steel, which we have the capacity to make here in America, and we could desperately use the job and the economic development. I'm sure you're aware of the special permit from the Department of Transportation that the company has applied for to use thinner pipe through the state of South Dakota. A condition of the state permit would be that we have the same thickness pipe that the cities are being protected with. And lastly, Bill Taylor, with all respect to Bill Taylor, he's a longtime family friend, but he's also the company's legal representation. And on the other hand, the Department of Revenue, whose job it is to review and come up with the numbers on issues like this, has been silent. And so I would think an audit of the numbers, a review of the numbers, a verification of the alleged taxes to the counties from the Department of Revenue would be in order.
Thanks, Ms. Trask. Applicant, any comments?
Certainly a long series of comments, and so I didn't actually appreciate the fact that there was a question to the applicant.
There wasn't.
And you need not respond if you don't want to, Mr. Jones. I just thought if you wanted to, we'd give you that opportunity. Okay. Other questions or comments?
I guess one of the questions, this is Tom Costello again. Rather than knowing the length of how long that pipeline is going to be active, I think as property owners, we'd be more concerned on whose responsibility, if they're going to tear the pipe out when they're done, or if they're just going to leave it lay and let it deteriorate under the ground, and if we're going to run into a deal with the pipeline, like with Homestake, where the landowner's going to have to pick up the expense to clean it up, or whether the state's going to come do it, or whether the pipeline company will do it when they're done.
It's a good comment. Thank you.
Okay. So I think the question was regards to, you know, what are the potential types of abandonment that we could expect at the end of the life of the project, and that is a reasonable question. So I can tell you that the practice that we've seen today, and it changes over years because, of course, we get a little more knowledgeable about things. But, you know, we're going to have to go through the same permitting practice as we have here with regards to abandonment. The techniques have been to put in inert gas in the line and keep the cathodic protection going. There have been areas where, you know, there's development, so the pipeline is removed. I mean, but these are really speculative. And so to say that we're going to do something in the future isn't considering what the rules are going to be at that time. But we're going to follow the rules. And, you know, so if we were to look at the rules today, that's what they would be.
Other comments or questions? Hand up in the... Okay,
go ahead. Can I follow up?
Yeah, sure.
I guess my question was more for the public utilities than for them. Are you guys going to have something in place that will determine who is going to pay the expense of the abandonment of the line?
Well, and consistent with, you know, Mr. Commissioner Hansen's comments earlier, you know, we're not going to make any commitments now. We're at the beginning of the process, but your comments will absolutely be considered as we go along. Good comments. Go ahead, sir.
Larry Nelson, that's NELSON.
to follow up a little bit on what Mr. Costello just talked about, he mentioned Barrick Gold. As I'm sure you folks know, when they got ready to, I guess we could call it decommission the mine there in Deadwood, they entered into a court proceeding with the state, and eventually arrived at an amount of money that they paid the state that was called for mitigation purposes to kind of, my term, pay the cost of the damages, of the environmental damages that were left over from that mining operation. And in that process, they shed their liability with the state. And consequently, the state mitigation is, as I understand it at least, is to replace that which has been damaged in these terms. And what the state then did was purchase land at the mouth of Spearfish Canyon adjacent to Spearfish with that money that was received in that settlement, or at least a portion of it. And Mr. John Cooper, who was then Secretary of the Game, Fish, and Parks, who was involved in that purchase when we were questioning about that, said, well, yes, Barrick did shed their liability with the state, but they had not shed their liability with the individual landowners. And really what we're talking about here is those folks that live along Whitewood Creek, the Belfouche River, and the Cheyenne River, who are now left with hazardous material deposits in those stream beds. Those folks, should some event happen later down the line, are now in the position where the Barrick has shed their liability with the state, and if they need to redress anything in the future, are going to be in the position of being individuals who are going to have to sue a foreign corporation to try to get anything fixed. And I guess my comment is this: I would hope that you folks, in your permitting process, and this goes down to the decommissioning of this pipeline at some point, put in place some process that doesn't end up leaving these landowners in that position where TransCanada at some point settles with the state, sheds their liability, and leaves individuals in the position of having to go after them should anything happen on their property as a result of the, at the end of that pipeline, which is exactly what has happened with the Homestake mine.
Thanks very much.
Dusty, if I could have, Commissioner Johnson, if I have one comment, and that's just to, reassure you that, there's 1.3 million miles of pipelines in the U.S., and so there is. This is an issue that all pipelines remain responsible as long as the pipeline is in the ground. And so I think it's a little different application than the one you've just described. But I just wanted to reassure you that Keystone will be responsible for the pipeline as long as it remains in the ground.
Other comments or questions? Comments or questions? Comments or questions? While people take a quick minute to collect their thoughts, I'll just mention that this is the beginning, really, of the comment process, the comment period. If 2 days from now you figure out there's something you want to share with the commissioners that you didn't have an opportunity to say tonight, that's fine. You didn't lose your opportunity. Call the Public Utilities Commission, talk to any of the staffers, and they'll kind of walk you through the process to make your voices heard. So we'll go, we'll check one more time. Yeah, and everything will be online. In fact, if you're curious about the process that was used for the last pipeline that was permitted in the state, we've got thousands of pages of information on our website on that. So go ahead, Mr. Costello.
Yeah, I would like if we get Senator Maher up and finish up his thoughts on what this might do to our school.
Absolutely. I I know Ryan well enough to know that I suspect his interest doesn't stop tonight, but rather he'll make sure to follow up and offer some comments as we move forward. Other comments or questions? Well, with that, then we'll just close by thanking you guys for your patience and your hospitality and really good questions and comments. Obviously, the folks of Harding County are looking not just next year or 10 years down the road, but generations, and that's a good thing to be doing. Thanks, everybody. Have a good night.